Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What roles did settlement, sugar, and slavery play in shaping the world as we know it today? The realization that Europe would pay nearly any amount for cane sugar in the 17th century marked a turning point for the colony of Barbados, which built the industry by becoming the first English colony to import African slaves to perform its most backbreaking tasks. Andrea Stewart can trace her ancestry back as far back as a British immigrant to Barbados named George Aspie, who arrived with next to nothing around 1640 and laid the cornerstone for what would become a sugar empire within a few generations, grown and cut and processed by slaves who are also Stewart's direct ancestors. She shares what she learned over years of research into her family's story and its relationship to the broader saga of New World settlement and slavery in her new book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family's Story of Slavery and Empire. Andrea, welcome to Think.
Hello, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about the layer of emotional complication that it added to look at this story, but also explore your own family history?
Well, I think the story of slavery is so, even without a personal connection, it's an enormously difficult, complex, disturbing world to look at. And when you kind of layer on top of that the realization that your family is kind of wrapped up in this story, it becomes, you know, even more difficult. The realization for me that my basically one set of my ancestors owned another set of my ancestors felt extraordinary. The idea that, you know, a father could own his son and to his daughters and so on, felt to me enormously kind of hard and difficult to manage.
You know, you mentioned a detail in the story that has stuck with me as much as anything else, and that is the idea that, a father owning his slave son or daughter. Slave owners, whether or not they were the biological parents of the slave children born on their plantations, felt they had the right to name them without asking the actual parents what they wanted.
Yes, I mean, that was quite common. Sometimes when one looks at the kind of plantation books, and this is true in mainland America or in the Caribbean, the naming practices are really quite derisory. Sometimes they, you know, call them things like, you could actually, on one plantation record that I looked at, there was this real similarity between the names of slaves and the names of the cattle on the plantation. Mm. And also you'd have these great fads, for example. There was a fad for Roman and Grecian names, and so you had Scipio and Dido and all that sort of stuff. And then, there would be another kind of naming phase or fashion the next year, and you could see that mirrored in the names of slaves. So it was a very kind of, and of course, as you said, they didn't consult the slave parents at all. It's quite common just to decide to name a child and just tell, of course, the parents, this is what they will be called. And that was that.
I guess that was another way of reinforcing the fact that those children were not, the parents had no claim on them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was a reminder that, of course, that these children belonged in reality, legally, certainly, to the planter, not to the parent. And it was a way of reinforcing that this child was part of a stock of people belonging to the planter, and that there was no legal kind of protection between a child and the parents who bore him.
So you were in Barbados in a museum library when you found George Aspie's name. Talk about the day that you made that discovery.
Well, George Aspie was, as you mentioned before, my first known New World ancestor, and he was an Englishman, a blacksmith. And I was looking, it took ages, as you can imagine, to go back that far. And then all of a sudden, I was sitting in a very cold air-conditioned room at the Barbados Museum and looked down and finally found this name, George Aspie, he owned 9 acres of land. He had one white servant, an indentured servant, that helped him farm this very small plot. And there he was in the 1650 census. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is my ancestor. And it was eight generations back, maybe more. I'm just trying to remember. I lose him sometimes. It's so long back. But, you know, so long ago. And there he was. And it was an immensely exhilarating moment because this meant that he was in the first, you know, kind of generation of settlement on the island, an Englishman who came over not long, because the island itself was settled first in 1627, so he was in the very early years of settlement on the island. And there he was, the beginning of our dynasty.
What were you able to learn about Ashby and why he might have left England for Barbados?
Well, I think there was a limitation on what I could learn about him. He was a small man, so a lot of it was supposition. He was a small planter. We knew that he was a blacksmith because of a mention in another document. But the chances are that he was probably a separating Puritan, one of those people who, he may not have been actively, like the Puritans who went to mainland America, driven primarily by religion, but he may have been to some degree a bit disillusioned by religious practices in England. But he was probably in reality, like most of the people who moved across to the New World, someone looking for new kind of possibilities, and, you know, wanting to create a fortune, maybe even just the desire to have to be able to own his own plot of land. In England at this point, only one in seven people own their own land. So they must have felt like a miracle, just the idea of being able to do that.
What was Barbados like before the arrival of the first European settlers?
Barbados was an empty island, which is quite unusual in that the last Amerindian population hadn't been there for 40,000 years. So it was essentially a giant jungle. So they arrived on this island, and it was impenetrable, beautiful and totally impenetrable. So that's what he arrived to, a wilderness, a beautiful wilderness, but a wilderness nonetheless.
And I guess the discovery of the suitability of the climate and the soil there for sugar production changed everything.
Yes, I mean, the first planters actually tried to grow tobacco. What they discovered, however, was that the tobacco grown on mainland America was much more successful because there was much more space, you could do crop rotations, and the expertise wasn't really there. So they tried that, but weren't competitive with, you know, Virginia and other places like that. So they realized that, you know, they were really looking desperately for a crop that would work on their soil. And then, hey presto, they discovered sugar, and they realized that they had found their cash crop. And it was a period, of course, when sugar was still a luxury that was really limited to a small minority of well-to-do people. So they realized not only had they got a cash crop, but they'd also got a cash crop which had a burgeoning marketplace. More and more people wanted to have it. Everyone, in fact, wanted to have it. So they were lucky, very lucky. They called it the white gold, and there's a good reason for that.
And initially, as you mentioned, George Ashby had a white indentured servant, and a lot of people on Barbados had white indentured servants. How did colonists make the transition to enslaving and importing human beings from West Africa?
Well, it's fascinating because people forget now that the early colonies in many parts of the Americas were, in fact, it was a European world in Barbados, certainly, in the beginning. There were some black slaves. The first ship that landed had captured some from the Portuguese, eight black slaves. But really, the predominant workforce was this white indentured servants coming over from England. In exchange for their passage, they worked for 5 years, and then with the hope of being free. So I think that there was that was the basis. What happened, of course, was sugar, partly because sugar was they realized that all they found this crop that people wanted, and they just wanted more and more of it. And the kind of the numbers of white indentured servants available to them from the English homeland just weren't enough to fill this endless void of workers that they needed. And at the same time, they were realizing, of course, that it was cost effective because you paid an indentured servant or paid for him, £7 or £8 for 5 years, while at the same time you could pay just a bit over that, double that, or for a slave for their entire life, as well as, of course, then, as well as their offspring. So it was really, really a very cost-effective move. And so I think a lot of it had to do with the economics of the situation.
We're speaking this hour with author Andrea Stewart. Her new book is called Sugar in the Blood, A Family's Story of Slavery and Empire. Join us in this conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or write a question or make a statement via email to think@kera.org. We'll come back to our discussion with Andrea Stewart in a couple of minutes. Want to take just a brief break here to talk to you about this hour of fundraising on Think. We are looking for 60 contributions during this hour, and if we can get to 60, an anonymous donor has promised an additional $1,000 to support the programming that you hear on KERA. We would really appreciate hearing from you now. Let's get this moving quickly at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back with us in studio. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We can thank you with your very own copy of Andrea Stewart's book, Sugar in the Blood. When you join the station with a $10 a month contribution, that's $120 all at once, or you can become a sustaining member of the station for $10 a month. Listen, this $1,000 is at risk here. This generous donor is going to give the station $1,000 if and only if we hear from 60 of you during this hour. And we've already let, a quarter of the hour plus slip away with a fascinating conversation. So please don't wait. Please call right now. 888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Or go online to kera.org. You can pick up the book as your thank you gift there as well and make your contribution.
Those of you who have been waiting for a truly fascinating read to choose as your thank you gift for supporting Think, this, I would venture to say, is it. It is a really compelling story. It's a humanized story. You get to sort of understand the lives of the people who are discussed in the book on both sides of the slavery situation. Really well told by Andrea Stewart. I learned a lot of things that I did not know before. We have not covered this specific aspect of the slave trade yet on this show. I think it's a terrific read. So again, you can receive your copy with our thanks when you join us at or above the level of $10 a month at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931.
We have heard from 11 listeners during this hour with contributions, so that's great. That means just 48 now left to go to make this goal, to meet this $1,000 challenge grant. We'd love to hear from you. Again, the phone number is 888-694-6931. The place online to do it, kera.org. I want to thank Kara Floyd in Dallas, who made a contribution and left her 7 words, morning, evening, noon, night, KERA brings delight.
Very nice. Nice to have something rhyming. We would love to hear from you with your 7 words, reasons why you support KERA. We would especially love to receive a contribution of financial support from you now. Think about joining the station for the very first time and see how great it makes you feel to support a community asset staffed by people who live and work in this community right alongside you, who really understand it and value it as much as you do. Do that by going online now to kera.org or calling in to 1-888-694-6931. We will speak again with author Andrea Stewart in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Andrea Stewart about her new book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 with a question or statement, or send email to think@kera.org. So, Andrea, to what extent did the system set up in Barbados become the de facto model for the practice of slavery throughout the New World?
Well, I think it's certainly true that what happened in Barbados was very influential across the English Americas. It was the first English colony that really thrived, and it was the first colony that really began to perceive itself as a slave economy. It was not the first colony with slaves, but it was the first colony that was run because it was a slave economy. And so it was quite different. It created very quickly, it had to create, the Barbadian planters worked out that they needed to create laws that control slaves, laws that kind of justified slavery. So they were very busy and very important, and they created a blueprint, really. And you can see them sort of grasping around legally. There's one of the laws, the first law, 1661, they talk about the fact that there is nothing in English law that shows them how to walk or how to manage this new reality, i.e. being running a society that was, you know, dominated by a slave culture, and how to police this and how to control this. So it was creating a blueprint, which then, as you can see it in many, many other countries, of the other colonies in English Americas, on mainland America, you can see it in Virginia or Carolinas and stuff like that. All these ideas were being replicated because they were putting together for the first time the rules of engagement between black and white on the plantation.
And on the British mainland, how did investment and profit from the sugar industry affect the economy?
Well, I mean, the sugar was the huge engine, incredibly lucrative, and so it had enormous influence in mainland Britain. Many people argue that it helped fuel the Industrial Revolution, and it certainly enriched a great many individuals and the culture generally. And certainly, if you live in England as I do now, the mark of sugar is everywhere. We have beautiful buildings like the Tate Gallery and also All Souls College in Oxford, and Harewood House, which is a beautiful mansion, and whole sections of Bristol and Liverpool and other big cities in London, and the city here where finances, which have been built by sugar money, you can see the mark of them. Everywhere you go, really, sugar's imprint has been left behind.
Is it common knowledge, Andrea, among British subjects that the legacy of those beautiful buildings and institutions is that they were built on the backs of enslaved people in the colonies, or do people in Britain chiefly think of slavery as a sort of an American institution?
Yes, I think that there is a real difficulty here. I think there's a real kind of disavowal of the reality that, you know, slavery was what was built, you know, this country was built partly on the back of the black slaves who worked for them in the colonies. I think it's easier in some ways because the slaves were working in a different part of the world. Mm-hmm. to create that disavowal, whereby people felt it somehow was something that happened a long time ago, somewhere far, far away. While I think on mainland America, because it was all on the same continent, it's harder to forget that story. And I think it's not something that people want to remember. I think that's also significant. It's not an attractive story in many ways, and people don't. I think Britain has a very much a kind of a fondness for a more attractive heritage story, you know, Downton Abbey and, kind of kings and queens and they really relished that part of their history. The part of the history that I belong to, and which many, many people belong to, is a lot less attractive and therefore much less emphasized and explored.
Well, you've made the point that because you have done all this genealogy for this book and for your own personal education, you can trace back your English ancestry a lot farther back than a lot of people whose families never left Britain. And yet, when you arrived there as a teenager from Barbados, you were made to feel very much like a foreigner who was sort of there by the grace of the largesse of the real, and I'm using air quotes there, British people.
Yes, I think that's exactly what one felt like. There's been a huge disconnect, of course, and I think that's exactly because there has been this kind of active forgetting of their Britain's historical past. So what you have is a kind of sense that somehow people don't make the connection that there was a reason why people came from the, black people came from the colonies to Britain. My father's generation, were brought up to believe firmly that they were British.
Mm-hmm.
And two of my uncles died in the war, fighting for Britain. And yet in England, I've never seen a movie by a British sort of producer that actually ever shows a black person in the RAF or in a submarine or, you know what I mean? Our story is constantly being actively forgotten, I think. And as a result, there is a real sense that Britain doesn't actually mainstream Britain doesn't realize just how long and how incredibly close this relationship was.
And it wasn't until 1966, right, that Barbados achieved complete independence from Britain.
That's right. It was very, very, that was very long, it wasn't that long ago. And so Barbados, was very much a part of England up until very, 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 very recently, really.
So how long did it take for George Ashby's descendants, the Ashby family, to build up what amounted to not a small sugar farm, but truly a sugar dynasty?
It was about four generations. So the dream of sugar for most people was that you would go and you would become rich immediately. And indeed, that was the case for some people. But for most people, any gold rush, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, it takes a long time to get rich, and so it was probably not until well into the end of the sort of 1700, 1775, right through into the early 1800s that the family. The ancestor who would really make a difference was born, and he was a man called Robert Cooper Ashby, who conveniently married an heiress, which helped a lot. And he was also, quite a good businessman, and he transformed the family's fortune. So they were a very minute and not particularly interesting kind of sugar family, and they grew to become quite a substantial one over those four generations.
And Robert Cooper Ashby had as many as 17 children working as slaves on his plantation, one of whom was your first slave ancestor in the New World.
That's right. Robert Cooper Ashby was, and in many ways we look back on history now as well, and you forget how frequently this was the story in plantations, both in the Caribbean and certainly on mainland America, where planters had very large, groups of children. My ancestor, Robert Cooper, had, as you mentioned, 17 at least, and these are just the ones we are pretty confident we can trace, so therefore probably many more, slave children who he sort of recognized to some degree, depending on, I think, the closeness of his relationship, their relationship with the mother, or, I don't know, perhaps his guilt, or whatever the reasons he had for justifying and taking care of them. But it's fascinating to see that, his legitimate white wife and him only had one child. So the bulk of his children were, in fact, slave offspring.
Mm. And you write about, very candidly, about the fact that you were not just frustrated, but in some cases heartbroken, that it was easier to know your early white ancestors in Barbados by name, whereas identities for your black ancestors couldn't be confirmed until later generations. Can you talk about how enslaved people were accounted for in official records?
I think the difficulty, of course, and I think this is true of slavery across the Americas, was that slaves were not, as they were not people, they were chattel. From the moment that they were, kind of taken away on a slave ship, they became non-people because, of course, they were numbers. So people, the slave ship captain would count them on and count who had survived, but they lost any sense of name or identity. Then they were renamed if they survived, and then so there was no process by which they could be kept tags on. And of course, the whole point was that the whole process of slavery, certainly Atlantic slavery, was about depersonalizing or depeopling the victims of slavery, so that they really didn't exist. So the only way they came into being was when their white ancestors, if they had them, or white owners, depending on the kind of level of detail in which they kept their workers. It was only through those things that they became known in the world. So we know about Robert Cooper's descendants because sometimes he mentioned them in manumissions, for example. He freed them, or sometimes he gave them particular privileges. Sometimes, in the case of our family, he preferred a particular naming strategy. So his slave children had often the same double-barreled first names. So there were different ways, and sometimes the planters gave them particular jobs on the plantation. In my case, he was given my ancestor John Stephen was allowed to be a carpenter, which meant that he wasn't working in the fields, and he was therefore, and he was, he was in a privileged position, and he could also make some of his own money by bartering his own, working on his own trade. So there are all those different ways that you can vaguely work out who are special to the planters, and it's through these things, inventories and compensation records and so on, that we know who these people are and who they and what they belong, what they are meant to for the planter himself, what this planter means to them, and how what they mean to the planter.
Author Andrea Stewart is my guest. We're talking about her new book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family's Story of Slavery and Empire. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. In this quick break, we want to update you on the status of fundraising for this hour of Think. We are looking for 60 contributions in this hour to receive an anonymous contribution of $1,000 additional. You hear us talking to you about a yearly contribution of, $60 or $120 or $240. So you know that $1,000, in an hour is great for us. So if you are in a position to make a contribution to KERA, a contribution in any amount now to help us meet this challenge, we would greatly appreciate it. We have 16 thus far. There may be some others on the phone, but we really need to step this up if we are to hope to make this a wonderful challenge grant from an anonymous donor. You can choose to receive a copy of Andrea Stewart's book, Sugar in the Blood, if your contribution is at the $10 a month level or above. And you can do that at kera.org or call in to 1-888-694-6931. Hey again, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris Boyd. I want to thank Ashley Bright in Arlington for making a contribution. And Ashley, seven words weren't enough for Ashley. Ashley said, I listen to KERA every single day. I wish I could contribute more. Thank you for providing me entertainment and joy. Ashley, thank you so much for making your contribution. You can join Ashley and help us achieve the remaining 44 contributions we need this hour in order to receive this additional $1,000 gift from a very generous listener and donor to the station. Please call 888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org. 44 contributions left to go. 44. Be the next one.
I believe that everyone who makes a contribution in this hour, assuming that we can make the challenge, can think of themselves as being the person responsible. It doesn't matter. You don't have to be the very last person to put your contribution in. If you are one of the 60, then you consider yourself personally responsible for helping us get this challenge.
Yeah, every one call is one less.
That's right.
That we have to, there's a little Spinal Tap logic in there, but it's it's so obvious, but it's true. I mean, we've got to get the 44 calls or online contributions in order to receive this $1,000 additional gift from a very generous listener. And that's up to you. I mean, if you've waited until today, and today could still be the next to last day of this membership campaign. We're hoping to wrap it up tomorrow with 7 on-air days. You know, it's still 7, 8, 9 days. I mean, that's still a pretty short membership campaign when you consider some of the drives we've had in the past. So making your contribution right now will help us make this goal and help us get to the overall goal. Just got an update, Chris. 21 are in the door, 39 left to go this hour.
You can make it 38, and eventually we will count down to 0 so that we have made this goal. I believe that Before Think, the Takeaway, did make their goal, and we would love to be able to match that or go far beyond it. We know we have a lot of very loyal listeners. A lot of you make a date with this show every day. You maybe brown bag your lunch, or you sit in your car and sort of listen to it as a break from your day. We would love to hear from those of you who consider Think part of your everyday listening habits. KERA.org is the online website, or you can call 1-888-694-6931.
So you're saying you want to blow away the Takeaway?
I want to blow away the Takeaway. That's right. At least in terms of fundraising support. Yes.
We need your help. 888-694-6931. Online at KERA.org. We've had a couple of good days during the Think Show, but I don't think we've heard from anyone at the $1,500 Friends level during the Think Show yet during this drive. So if it's time for you to renew your Friends membership, and you can do that, that's $125 a month as a sustaining friend, well, give us a call, 888-694-6931.
You get to hear the high-quality radio production that your dollars pay for every single day. Think of your contribution to KERA not as a donation, but as an investment in your own education and in quality journalism. Those things are worth paying for. We know that your support will come in, and we appreciate you just taking action sooner rather than later, meaning now. KERA.org or 888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Andrea Stewart about her new book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family's Story of Slavery and Empire. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Andrea, what changed for your family in particular, and for Barbados as a whole, in and after mid-1834, when all of the slaves that had been in British territories were emancipated?
I think the emancipation was kind of wonderful, but also vaguely anticlimactic in a strange way. I think there was a real sense for the slaves, of course, that you know, that the new possibilities were opening up, and that the world was going to change, and for the first time that their children were going to lead a different life from their own. And of course, for planters like Robert Cooper Ashby, it must have felt like the end of the world, you know, cataclysmic. The world that they had thrived in, and which they'd fought and defended and they worshipped, was over. So I think there was a great deal of grief on one side of the family, of course, and a great deal of happiness at the same, on the other side. But I think it took a long time, really, for the plantation system to really come to an end. I think Barbados and the other Caribbean islands were dominated by the sugar kind of world for, you know, right until quite recently. I mean, my parents, my mother's family's sugar plantation only stopped producing sugar properly about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's not a story that is that comes to an end quickly. It's an old story, and it had a long shadow over the islands, not just the islands, but of course, you think about Brazil and all the other South American territories where, it's cast a long shadow for a lot of countries.
Do you have mixed emotions now visiting the land that was your mother's family's plantation? And we should say they owned it and prospered from it, but it still has such a checkered history.
Yes, it's weird. It's strange because I think as a child, I remembered it with great, great affection, be going there. I don't think I had any sense that I was part of a slightly privileged caste of Barbadians who the kind of people who own the plantation as versus the people who work the land. And I think I was kind of innocent of all that. It was just a magical place because plantations can be very beautiful. The plantation house was impressive, and we had our own gardens and wonderful, kind of land around it, and then the cane fields around that. And it was amazing to go to bed, with this sound of cane whistling at night. It was beautiful. So as a child, it was a place of great memories. And it was only, I think, as I grew older, and certainly as I really understood what the backstory of all this was, that it became a more ambivalent place for me.
How much did you rely on stories told by relatives in your living memory? I know you had an uncle who was really an extraordinary storyteller.
I think that definitely my uncle and the stories that I heard about the past was probably the thing that made me become fascinated with family stories. I think, for a lot of us, something triggers it, doesn't it? That desire to know more about things. And his stories were so funny and sad and marvelous that I became fascinated by the family. But it was also that other thing that happens with people, with many of us, is that realization that if you don't know, you don't find out about your family history now, you'll lose it. Do you know what I mean? That your parents are getting older, your family, you're losing members of the family. And so the choices are that you either go for it or you will lose this link to the past forever.
Do you think the particular history of Barbados affects the way the things the culture finds funny and the way they deal with conflict and things like that even today?
Oh, definitely. I think that there are sort of dynamics that are set up in the way that people operate with each other that just persist, really. A lot of what you find in contemporary Barbados is very much mirrored in kind of these old stories, and some of them are kind of sad and some of them are very funny. And certainly there are patterns of behavior, I can afford to be amused by my discovery that my grandfather, for example, rather like Robert Cooper Ashley, his, great-great-great-grandfather, had illegitimate children with women who worked the land. And I shouldn't laugh at it, but I can afford to because my granny had died when I found this out, and he'd gone as well. But it was certainly very entertaining to discover that, that he'd replicated completely the same patterns. I mean, there's a way that was tragic, but it was also, sometimes we found out about these things in quite hilarious ways. I remember being approached in a nightclub in Barbados, and a girl saying to me, "I'm your cousin," and I said, "Oh, really?" And she was one of the children of these women, and you know what I mean? So it was serendipitous and quite amusing. And of course, for me, it doesn't hold any, animus or any unpleasantness. But the past really does create the present, doesn't it, for all of us in many ways.
So you've written also independent of this book about the decisions that you need to make with regard to communicating all of these stories and what they mean and how they contribute to identity to your own daughters. Can you talk a little bit about the things that have played into that thinking for you?
Well, I think it's that you kind of, it's a very big story, and one of the things about living in Britain, and I think that's, I'm assuming it's different in the US, is that I don't want them to fall into the amnesia that has been the collective response in Britain to their past. I want them to know this story and to know it in a way that makes them proud of their black ancestors, and, you know, to make them understand the complexity of the backstory of what was, and how hard, for example, the slaves themselves fought to free themselves from slavery. In Britain, the rhetoric is very much along the line of the abolitionists came along and very kindly freed old slaves in the Caribbean and so on.
As opposed to people taking a stand for their own rights and fighting for themselves.
Exactly, and that's something that's really very underestimated here. I mean, and, you know, the great struggle of the Haitian people and, you know, the 12 years of battling both the French army and the British army to sustain and to create and then sustain their freedom. So I want them to know what this story was meant, and also to take pride in the incredible resilience and strength of my ancestors, you know, our ancestors, in just being able to survive such a brutal and persistently sort of damning sort of system. It's, you know, I think to have managed to create a constructive sense of self, a constructive notions of family, to have lived a productive and wonderful life post-slavery is a real achievement and something to be incredibly proud of.
To visit Barbados today, Andrea, I mean, is all this history sort of available for people who want to take tours and get off the beach and away from the umbrella drinks for a little while and actually learn something?
Yes, I think, I mean, Barbados is, yes, I mean, there are, you know, there's a wonderful museum there, and certainly there is a great deal of, you know, kind of, you know, historical discussion, art lectures, and people are talking about it, and it's part of the syllabus and so on, which is not the case in Britain. So there is a real sense of people owning this past, which is wonderful, really.
The new book by author Andrea Stewart is called Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. Andrea, it really has been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been delightful. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks to all of you who are listening. We also want to thank those of you who are becoming new members of KERA or renewing memberships or giving additional gifts. We have heard from 23 of you thus far this hour. We are looking to get to 60 in order to achieve the additional $1,000 challenge grant. Okay, we have 26 now. We need to get to 60 to receive the additional $1,000 challenge grant from a listener, an anonymous donor to KERA. Please do not have us leave this amount of money on the table. Make a contribution now in any amount by going online to kera.org or calling in to 1-888-694-6931. You may now be really interested to read Andrea Stewart's book, Sugar in the Blood, A Family Story of Slavery and Empire. There are a lot of aspects to this story, fascinating things, dramatic occurrences that we couldn't get to in an interview that was just an hour long. So if you would like to read it, we would love to send you a copy with our compliments. It's available today at the membership level of $120 a year or $10 a month at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back in studio now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Sorry, I spilled my water in the control room. I got so excited.
I
got to go back and work on it. But what I'm working on right now is convincing you to support the station at 888-694-6931. That's the place to call. And you know what, Chris? We've heard from 26 listeners during this hour. That's fantastic. Thank you so much. But that means we still have 34 calls to receive in order to achieve the 60 call or online contribution goal to receive the additional $1,000 from a generous listener. So we're still waiting to hear from you and 25 other folks at 888-694-6931 or on the web at kera.org.
You are are a lifelong learner. We know that much about just about everybody who listens to this station, who goes online to the website and looks for content there. We love being able to serve an audience that wants to hear about, you know, aspects of the slave trade and its legacies outside the United States. It's a conversation that we think is worth having. The scholarship by Andrea Stewart is really extraordinary. It was great to be able to talk to her. If you are a lover of information to the extent that you want to listen to a conversation like this for an hour, or you want to hear an author like Anna Hamoyan for an hour about the contemporary girls and the struggles that they are having, then you also must recognize that it takes money to bring quality journalism like this. If we sort of turned the corner and were like everybody else and ran 20, 25 minutes of commercials every hour, then we wouldn't have to ask you for money. But we have to think that nobody wants that, right? We know that you don't want to listen to commercials. You don't want our content to be really influenced by the advertisers, as opposed to influenced by what we know that you are interested in hearing about and learning about. So support this at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931.
Online at KERA.org, on the phone, 888-694-6931. Don't forget, we've got Downton Abbey DVDs. You can get the currently airing season 3 of Downton Abbey, which is incredibly popular. If you haven't seen last Sunday night's episode, chances are you've probably heard all about it already out on the GigaWeb. Well, we can give you the entire season 3 with our thanks when you join the station with a $120 contribution. If you make it $240, we'll thank you with the entire run of the show thus far, seasons 1, season 2, and season 3, for your DVD library. What a great thing. If you're a Downton Abbey fan, maybe your significant other is a Downton Abbey fan, or you have a friend or a family member who you think would love to have this, and you're supporting KERA all at the same time, call 888-694-6931 or check it out online at kera.org.
And remember that, of course, this would be a contribution for 2013 rather than the past 2012 tax year. But it's always so exciting if you itemize your taxes to suddenly remember all of the charitable contributions you have made. And it's great to be able to sort of enter that in. I use a computer program and, you know, you'll see that has affected the amount of taxes that you pay. So if this is something that you do, it's also just a nice little perk of being a KERA member. You can go online to KERA.org, where, by the way, you can check out thank you gifts. So if you heard us talking about a non-woven polypropylene shopping bag, or you heard us talking about the Think mugs, or you heard us talking about any number of items, and you've been waiting for that to come back up again, it might not come up in our discussion on the radio, but it is very likely still available. And if that will make the difference for you, by all means, let us know that, and we will make that happen. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number, or take care of it all online at kera.org.
26 still, we're stalled at kind of 26 contributions that have come in. Again, that means still 34 needed to make this challenge. $1,000 is at risk. We can achieve the goal of 60 calls or online contributions with your call right now. You and 3 other people. That's who we need to hear from right now at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. You know, you can't count on somebody else to make the contribution for you unless you're in a situation where you can't afford to give. And you know what? Public Radio and KERA are here for every single person, no matter what their situation is. And if you can't afford to give to the station at this time, well, you know what? That's why Public Radio is here in the first place, is so that everybody has access to important news and information. Chances are there'll be a day when you can give to the station, and when you can, that's great. But if you're in a position right now where you can afford to give some money to the station to make a contribution at whatever level is right for you, then I urge you to do it right now when we have not only the goal of finishing the membership campaign as soon as possible, but also achieving this challenge and getting an additional $1,000 for the station.
And let's face it, if you're in a position to give to the station and you're not giving, but you listen all the time, you have to really ask yourself why that's the case. Really, public radio is set up so that everybody who listens supports just a little bit of the cost of it, so we will have this thing. Please make your contribution now at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. And here's a special note to my darling podcast listeners, you might be listening to this days after the time that this went on and saying to yourself, oh, I would have given to the drive, but clearly it must be over. Well, the truth is, we always have folks, always at 1-888-694-6931 who can take your call, your pledge call. We also, of course, the KERA.org website is always set up so that you can make a contribution of support. If you are a regular podcast listener, you value this, you tell your friends about it, we would really love a gift from you in any amount, even a symbolic amount, $10, $20 would go a long way toward continuing to provide you the coverage that you love. Thank you so much for your support. We really appreciate it.